simple, and the only reason we're not there is because we haven't decided to do it. An awful lot of the public believes that. We're not close to having anywhere near the technology or the economics to put astronauts on Mars and bring them back alive. We're not close to that yet.
Repeater, time out.
And I don't think we're going to be close to that for 20 years. Elon Musk thinks he's going to make a rocket that's going to circle Mars, and people are going to take a trip just to do it for the fun. I don't believe it. He's also building some very fast tunnels that are going to go under the Earth to get you from New York to from Boston to... I think it's from Baltimore to Washington in a very short period of time. That's a more reasonable project. But maintaining human beings in space is a lot more difficult. And this book called Packing for Mars by Mary Roach gives you some of those details. And there's a lot more to it than the public knows about. Maybe we've said enough pessimistic things for one night. Maybe it's time for a space report. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, KQRW. Tell us some pleasant things that NASA has been doing.
This is WS2N. I'll go back to reality. Science fiction, I love it, but what's more important to me is the reality. Talking about spacewalk, two astronauts today, Randy Resnick and Joe Acaba, they did a spacewalk this week on Friday, and they completed, just, we're talking about how many spacewalks, the third spacewalk in as many weeks, or in a couple of weeks, they've done a couple of other spacewalks. Each one is about 7 hours long. Total amount of spacewalks for the year, including Russian spacewalk, and it's always two people at a time, never one person at a time, is 10 for 2017. I think they're going to do one more toward the end of the year, and then we're going to do a brand new year, 2018. This was successful. They changed some cameras out that were effective. The main purpose of all three spacewalks, let me drop it, was to change out the, they call it the LEE, the latching end effector. Latching end effector is end part, this 4,000 pound part that's on the end of this 57 foot long robotic arm that Canada has put up there. On one end they have an end effector, and the other end of the 57 foot arm they also have an end effector. So they're able to attach themselves to the space station, move this 57 foot arm to another location, attach to the space station, disconnect from that one, and they can go like that quite a few different times to any different location on the space station. That when they're attached, the other end is not attached, and they were able to take the end effector and attach it to either an astronaut when he's doing a spacewalk, or they're able to grab a cargo vehicle that's coming up to the space station to resupply the space station. It was also used heavily in building the space station anytime they needed to put up a truss section on the 340-foot-long ISS or different modules. This thing would take them out of the cargo bay of the shuttle and attach them to the space station. So that this end effector eventually starts to wear out. I mean, they thought they were going to get maybe 10 years or so out of it. They've gotten longer. Went up to 2001. And it's been there all these years. So it's gotten a little tired. So they decided to replace it. They had spare parts bought up on one of the shuttles years ago, and it was attached to the outside of the space station. So they had spare parts. And that was the goal, to change this out. They successfully have done it in three different space walks. And toward the end of this last space walk, they did have one problem. You know, all the work and everything was completed. They changed out cameras that they needed to change out, lights, some get-ahead work, and the main part of changing out this latching end effect. One problem they had is the safer suit. They call it the safer suit is something that the astronauts use in case there's a problem. It's called a simplified aid for EVA rescue. Years ago, you might remember the manned maneuvering unit, big units that they looked like they were sitting in, and they would be able to fly away from the space shuttle and attach themselves to a satellite and come back and drop it. In the 1980s, they were doing that. They've done away with that. It seemed a little too risky. No tether whatsoever. So from that manned maneuvering unit, they've developed the safety unit. This unit that is attached to the space outside of their spacesuit. In case they ever get disconnected from the space station, they can use it. It has nitrogen inside, nitrogen jets, and they can fly themselves back to the space station if need be. It's never had to be used yet, but it's there in case of an emergency. One of the astronauts, Joe Ackbert, the mission control noticed when he was working on the latching end effector that the controller for the safety unit was dislodged from the suit, just hanging there. So his partner came over and he checked it out. Sure enough, it was on in the on position, and there was no more gas left. It was bleeding off gas during the whole 7 hours. And it carries about a little over 3 pounds of pressure, you know, 5 pounds of nitrogen gas, and completely on. So that was the end of the mission anyway. So they were at the very end. They eventually got themselves back to the Quest airlock and went inside, and everything was fine. But in doing that, they made sure, you know, they always make sure about the tethers, always at least one tether is attached, and this time they double made sure because they didn't want him flying away, because if he did, there would have been no chance of him again, you know, coming back. So that was an interesting thing that happened. The next year, they plan on doing the other end of the latching end effector. Like I said at the beginning, there's two of them, one at the end of the 57-foot robot arm, and then the other one at the other end. And they have actually three purposes. They're able to grab a hold of something, a spacecraft or a science telescope or whatever they're grabbing, and adapt it to put inside this thing that automatically attach whatever unit they're connecting to. Not only does it grapple it, it actually can provide power to whatever unit we're talking about. So it provides power and also data. It's got a data link, so it could actually direct or tell this unit whatever it wants it to do. So it's a real involved system. Early next year, they plan on replacing the other latching end effector, which they've used both over the years, the A unit, the B unit. They were going to change the A unit out. They found out the B unit was failing. First, it had some motor problems, so they changed out B. Next year, they'll change out A. Let me drop this WS. And we're getting toward the end of the year, so we're looking forward to a launch from Wallops Island. You have the Antares rocket that will be launched by Orbital Science. Not this week, another week or two from now. November 11th, it'll be a Saturday morning. So we'll be able to actually see it, even though it's going to be daytime, 7:37 Eastern Standard Time. If you go out to the base, Long Island, if you base to the south and to the west a little bit, you should be up, it'll be about 15 degrees above the horizon. But that will be bringing the Cygnus cargo spacecraft up to the International Space Station, one of the cargo vehicles that we were talking about earlier in the net. It's going to be called the Eugene Cernan. They give it a name. Every one of these that has gone up, the biggest ones, have been named after an astronaut that has passed away. And Eugene Cernan was the last man to walk on the moon. He died last year. So they named it after him. And that should be an interesting flight to watch go up. They'll be using the new Antari rocket motors. The RG-181 motors, they replaced the older ones that blew up that one time, the Russian ones. Although these are also Russian engines, they're not the same ones that were deemed effective. Drop it. I'll just try to go through the rest of those very quickly here. The Iridium satellite was launched a couple weeks ago. They call it the Iridium Next system. The platform is Iridium Next 3. It's the third grouping that has gone up. Each one is 10 satellites. They now have a date for the next one to go up. Iridium Next 4, another 10 satellites will be going up in December. Again, launched on a Falcon 9 SpaceX rocket. Each one is about 2,000 pounds, so each one gets released separately. Gets up to orbit, and they'll have probably about another two or three launches after that. But this is called Iridium Next 4. Interesting thing about this particular flight, the Falcon 9 booster for the fourth time will be reused. Falcon 9 booster is about 150 feet, a little longer than 150 feet long, 12 feet diameter. And that's, SpaceX thing is shoot for reusability to bring down the cost of space travel. They've done this three times so far, taking three different, not the same booster over and over again, but three different boosters out of three previously flown, and flown them. They're now going to use another one. That'll be the fourth one. They've recovered about 18 of these things so far, so they have a lot of storage. They'll take the Falcon 9 booster, put it on the next satellite, and launch it from Vandenberg Air Force Base out in California. That's where they launched the particular Iridium satellite. Thing that's different about this one is every flight that they've been able to save a booster leaving from California has landed in the Pacific Ocean on a drone ship. Each drone ship is about as big as a football field. This time around, they're not going to do that. They finally got an approval from the FAA to allow the booster to come back to land. It's only going to land in, it's going to actually land in another spaceport right next to when they launch from. They launch from Launch Complex 4E, that's going to be down in 4W. So it's about 1,400 feet away from where it's going to take off from. So it should be quite interesting to have see this thing come back from space from 60 miles up and come all the way back to California. They've done it a number of times, a half dozen times or so in Florida. This will be the first time that they accomplished that in California. Let me drop it. One thing Bill was talking about was Bigelow Aerospace. They've apparently gone into a contract or worked on a contract with ULA, United Launch Alliance. ULA is a consortium of Boeing and Lockheed together to launch their Bigelow expandable habitat. much bigger than the one that's presently attached to the International Space Station. Much bigger. The thing will be able to give an idea. If it was opened up all the way, on the inside, you'd have the equivalent of one-third the amount of room that's on the International Space Station now. International Space Station has about as much room as living on a 747, but it would be about one-third of that. They plan on launching this to Earth orbit by 2022, earliest, put it into Earth orbit, and leave it there, and then once it's opened up, send up a couple of other rockets to dock with it, and then bring equipment and, build up the insides of this thing, what it needs. Once it's expanded, you'll be able to do that. It'll be in Earth orbit for 1 year, and eventually two more rockets will be launched from Earth, also from United Launch Alliance, and they're going to dock with that, and they're going to have, it will be a booster, actually, to be able to send it to the moon. That booster will be quite empty when it gets there, so they're going to send another booster up to refuel that one. So it'll be fully fueled, 30 tons of fuel, and they'll be able to launch this Bigelow expandable vehicle that Bill was talking about, all the way to the moon, put it at the moon orbit, and it'll be a manned space station in lunar orbit, different than the Deep Space Gateway that NASA is developing. That will be independent. That will be another lunar space station. Deep Space Gateway is being developed by NASA and Lockheed. They plan on having real steel modules to be in place for one going around the moon. Probably, within a certain amount of years, I'll say 5, 6, 7 years, 8 years, at the most, you'll have at least two space stations in orbit around the moon. One other thing I wanted to talk about real quick is another project called the Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigation, Geodesy, and Heat Transport. It's called InSight. InSight's going to go to Mars. I'm dropping it. We've covered InSight many times years ago. It was delayed a couple of years ago because it had a problem. I'm not going to go into that right now, but it's basically a seismic craft that's going to be landing on Mars. It's going to be launched in May, and it will be landing in Mars in November. You could actually go to Jet Propulsion NASA site and log on, put in your name, and they will send your name digitally on a chip that will be attached to the lander. So this way, when it lands on Mars next November, you can say, well, your name is on Mars. 800,000 people have already done this for the previous launch that didn't go off, that was delayed because they had problems. And now they're going to have another chip, and you can get your name in before November 1st. They'll put your name on the next ship. That's it for now. I have more stories, but I'm going to run out of time here, Dick. Back to that K2RIW, WS2N. Space portion of the TechNet.
To get your name on the InSight, I think it is. Is there a cost for that? And I'm going to guess that there isn't very much of a cost. Maybe it's none. On top of that, I should have asked earlier. Because the meteor shower that occurred this weekend could have been quite significant, because we've got, for the last few days, very clear air and no moon. So the Orion meteors that started late Friday night into Saturday morning and into Sunday morning, I wonder if any of you guys out there took the time to look at the meteor shower. Give me a call that is right now if you did, if you know anybody who did. Keep your eyes on you listening.
No, but I have a question related to that, though. I did look for it, though.
Okay. Were you in a dark enough area? Did you look long enough? And how many did you see? To be 2RYY, K2RYW, great show.
Went at about 12:30 at night, Friday night and Saturday night. Didn't see anything. It was out for like a length of time, maybe 40 minutes or so. Looked up pretty much in like one spot in the sky. Didn't really see anything. But my question was, they said something about, unless they just misunderstood something, or didn't hear it correctly, this was the remnants of Halley's Comet. And I didn't quite understand that because I thought that comet goes around the Earth, it comes near the Earth once every 76 years. How could there be remnants of that comet making up these meteor showers? Back to you.
Let me answer that last question about InSight first before you go on to.
You got a pull.
No cost. You just put your name in and they'll send you they call it a boarding pass. I guess you can put it, print it out in your printer. And you also get 3 miles, miles out of it. So I don't know what that's going to give you, but no, there's no cost. Those 3 miles aren't going to do me any good. I'm not flying anywhere. Any kind of...
Did you list your name? Is your name going to be put on Mars, Paul?
No, I haven't done it because they offered us quite a bit. They did it with the first test Orion mission that went up in 2014. They shot it up on the Delta IV. They've done it with a couple of the other ones. New Horizon had a program like that. So. No, I don't want to do that. If it doesn't make it to Mars, I don't want my name orbiting Earth, orbiting the sun in a for eternity. Back to you, Nick.
Okay. 800,000 people have done it, and you're not one of them. You've been left out. Now, Halley's Comet, just like any other comet, periodically comes in very close to the sun. Quite a bit of material boils off the surface of that comet. That material boiling off the surface is what creates the tail. When you see a comet tail, that's massive material leaving that comet. All that massive material has been coming off that comet for thousands of years. Halley's Comet is not something that was just recently invented. It's been around for a long time. Lots of centuries. So that material that boils off, sometimes it's a fine dust that looks like the tail, and sometimes it's great big chunks. But that dust, slowly being boiled off that comet every time it comes near the sun, doesn't stay right near the comet. It gets spread out. If you look at the orbit of that comet, throughout that whole orbit, there's material spread out that far. I would guess none of that orbit has zero material. So every time the Earth's journey around the sun allows us to hit a portion of that orbit, that material enters our atmosphere. In the case of this particular meteor shower, they claim it's hitting at 41 miles per second, or is it kilometers per second? I think it was miles per second. Which is, the Earth is moving around the sun at 19 miles per second, but those chunks of that meteor, the meteor...
Repeater, time out.
The meteoric material of Halley's Comet enters the Earth's atmosphere at 41 miles per second. So obviously it's coming at us directly head on, if you know what I mean, faster than we're moving around the sun. And it's got a much bigger orbit, and that makes some sense. For all I know, Halley's Comet goes around the sun clockwise while we go around the sun counterclockwise, but by some means, 41 meters per second is average velocity of that material. And you probably know that the meteor shower has that name because the material that enters our atmosphere looks like it's coming from the constellation of Orion. So does that make some sense, Joe? To be HRIYY, HRIW in the tech net?
Yes, it does. The way you explain it makes a lot of sense to me. I can understand it. And I have another comment. When you go to the movies, you should leave the scientist home. Only kidding.
Yes, I know I'm a nitpicker. But as I said, there's two things that bother me. One, these drastic errors. It seems like 98% of the audience doesn't recognize them. And second of all, these movies, although they're not intended, left-handedly, they are educational material. And I'm disappointed that it is a mis-education, that we're getting the very wrong impression as to how easy it is to do some of these things in space, for instance. So, it wouldn't have taken a great deal of extra effort to get some of these details right. It wouldn't have doubled the price of the movie. It would have increased the price of the movie by 5%. Maybe even less. The people who wrote the book and the people who did the screenplay for the movie did, they were making these errors. They didn't intentionally make errors. They didn't know. Just like there's an awful lot of holes in our education. And one of those holes of our education is how heavy is air. And that's important if you're trying to understand, let me drop this. You're trying to understand how destructive is a bomb. How does an airplane fly? And I'm amazed that people haven't put it together with their lifelong experience. When you were 8 years of age and you were in your father's car and the car is moving at 40 miles an hour, and you hung your hand at that window, and you tilted your hand, the palm of your hand, in various directions, and you felt that air pressure. We all forgot about how heavy that air felt at that time. As I said, the average engineer thinks that air has 10 milligrams of mass per cubic meter. That's more than a million to one wrong. I mean, if there were 2 to 1 wrong, I'd understand it. To be a million to one wrong, that the whole concept has never been conveyed during our normal method of grade school and high school education. It's a perpetuating problem. I just chose that particular one. There's a zillion things like that. And some of these movies are, unfortunately, propagating some of this misinformation because no one worries about these details. They don't know to worry about the details. They don't know that they don't know. That's the sad part. They're in the first state of knowledge. So, on the subject of the meteor shower, you didn't get a chance. I forgot about it. You didn't look at it either, Paul, WS2N, KQIW?
I read about it, but no, I didn't go out and look at it. You know, by the time that night came, I forgot about it. Just go back to your Martian movie a second. The whole movie would have been in trouble right from the beginning because they had this 200 mile an hour wind that's supposed to pick up this antenna and stab him in the leg and all of that. You know, if you were on Mars, you could go out and stand in a 200 mile an hour wind because the atmosphere is only 0.1% of what we feel here. Yeah. So there's the pressure against your body and what we even know. The rovers that are riding around on Mars right now, you know, would have never lasted in dust storms that come by that clean off the panels. You know, they have a dusty panel, hardly getting any power to the rover. And all of a sudden this windstorm comes by and it lightly blows everything off, but the rover doesn't go blown off the hill back here.
That's a good point, Bill, Paul. The way the moving, the wind in the moving the Martian blew, and that was true. And all of our rovers on Mars would have been blown over. They would have been flipped over on their sides. The wind, as fast as it is such an extreme and tenuous light wind, it's able to remove the dust off of the solar panels of, I can't think of the name now, of the rover, the early rover that we sent there.
Spirit and Opportunity.
Spirit and Opportunity was the later one. What was the very first one? The little rover car.
They named it Sojourner, and then the car that bought it there, that stayed there, that didn't ride around, was called Pathfinder. Then they renamed that honorable Carl Sagan, called now the Carl Sagan Memorial.
Yep, I remember Sojourner. But if the wind was anything like in the movie, Sojourner would have been flipped over on its side. Spirit and Opportunity would have been flipped over on this side. And the great big one right now, that's the size of a Volkswagen, it would have been blown over on its side. So, there were some significant errors in that movie. And I guess that's the one part, if they got it right, they would have lost a major portion of the story. How he got the leg injury and how he got left. And the chances of him being subjected to that injury, and they ended up believing him, and he survived, the chances of all that happening in reality, boy, that's a one in a million chance. What do you think, Paul? WS2N? C2LIW?
C2IS coming.
Yeah, his blood froze, the liquid in the blood froze, stopped the leak, on and on. But a lot of problems. It's a great, great movie, but you know. That guy that wrote that book, Weir, I think Roy said, he collaborated with NASA quite a bit. He was at NASA before he wrote the book. Naturally, this movie came out of the book. Back to you.
I'm going to go over to Bill in a second. Near the end of the movie, he pokes a hole in the side of the spacesuit in order to have air escaping, to act as a jet, in order for him to propel himself over to be rescued. And he's letting air out of the suit fast enough to do that without him passing out inside because of a lack of air pressure. The chances of somebody really doing that and surviving and directly steering yourself that way, oh, my goodness, what degree of difficulty that is there. Again, you have to suspend reality while you're watching that movie. AC2IS, K2LIW. Am I being too pessimistic, Bill?
This is AC2IS. Yeah, if you could just forgive that movie of the one primary sin, which is consistently overestimating the air pressure on Mars, I think things would hang together a lot better for you. The spacesuit that he was wearing when he was injured, I believe, had the ability to automatically repressurize after some period of time, which is not a typical capability I think you'd have in a spacesuit. To sort of wait some period of time and then try to repressurize. But, you know, maybe that repressurizing spacesuit would help him direct those gases and help him fly like Iron Man. But yeah, if you could forgive that movie, the one sin of consistently overestimating the air pressure on Mars, which at least they were consistent about, I think things would look a lot better. And one other thing in my investigation of aeroponics is I think in 2015 or 2016, I forget, NASA actually grew some stuff in space. People were able to eat in space. I think it was lettuce. And they have growing systems that apparently are based on LED lighting. So there's something to address your windows and the lack of sunlight. You need a whole bunch of solar panels in order to collect enough energy to funnel into LEDs, and the, you know, you'd have to worry about the efficiency problems with solar panels and so forth. But presumably the LEDs buy you some efficiency by the fact that they can emit light in just the right frequency for your crop, assuming that you are designing for that purpose. I'm not sure if you commented on the oxygen generators on the space shuttle. Would they be as inadequate on Mars? That's what I got for the moment. ACJS.
Yeah, I think Paul told us about the oxygen generator on Mars, on the International Space Station. I think a lot of the oxygen is coming from electrolysis of water. In other words, rather than carry oxygen tanks in the Progress ship, they're carrying water, knowing that those massive solar panels on the International Space Station can supply the raw power to do the electrolysis that separates the oxygen from the water. And the amount of oxygen that's in water is already in a very compact form, equivalent to what you'd have to put it into a very high pressure container if you were shipping pure oxygen. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, KQLIW?
Yeah, the space station, they're up to like 97% of oxygen being replenished. So, over, a little over 97%. What they're doing is, like you said, electrolysis. And then for emergencies, they have these oxygen candles that they can actually ignite, and they when it's burning, they can put up oxygen. That's, you know, for emergency purposes. That's really a Russian design. The water that they bring up, you know, plenty of water to do what they're doing, but not enough to replenish it at the 97% rate. So all moisture coming off the body and everything is all recycled. And you know, they'll take that water that's being recycled and they will continue the electrolysis process. And that's the oxygen. And then there's also a saboteur unit located in the Tranquility unit. Node or module drop.
Yeah, what I think Bill is really asking to some degree is that the oxygen, the astronauts are breathing air at 14.7 pounds per square inch, taking in the oxygen, exhaling carbon dioxide. When you talk about the 90 some odd recovery, does that mean that the carbon dioxide exhaled by the astronauts, instead of it just being shoved into a lithium hydroxide filter and being captured in the filter and thrown away, I'd like to believe that the carbon dioxide that they're exhaling is being recycled back into oxygen. Is that sort of true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW, wait for the beep.
Repeater, time out.
Yes, that's what I was getting to. That's the saboteur unit. That's located in the Tranquility module. And that unit takes the carbon dioxide that's in the air, converts it, takes the oxygen out, and then the carbon crystallizes and becomes like a hard substance. And over time they have to scrape that off or whatever they're doing with it. And then that becomes waste. In the future, there's going to be one more step after that, so they can have 100% cycle on that. Not sure of the chemistry of that, but I've read it, but I keep forgetting. But they're working on that third and final cycle. So yes, that's what happens. The carbon dioxide is recycled. If you see the movie The Martian, don't know if it's in the book or the movie. I've read the book and I've seen the movie, and I confused the two. But I believe he had a saboteur unit. It wasn't in the movie, then he had it in the book. And he put it into one of the rovers. He took two rovers off with him. One he used as a trailer, and the other one he pulled with him. He drove, and he went, you know, hundreds and hundreds of miles to get to the launch site. So with that, he had to take this saboteur type unit for getting rid of the carbon dioxide. Back to you.
So the human being is consuming water, food, and oxygen, metabolizing that, and the lungs are giving off carbon dioxide. The carbon that's in that carbon dioxide was originally in the food that you consumed. So you can take that carbon dioxide, recycle it to get the oxygen back out with the saboteur unit. And in theory, if you could be using the carbon, I guess you could reconstruct to some degree the food that he ate. What the Earth does, it's hard to believe, what the Earth does is take every single molecule of solid, liquid, and gas that comes off of a human being as waste products, and over the next 100 years, so to speak, Mother Earth recycles all of that. In theory, it would be nice for a long-range spacecraft to be able to do that. Use the solar panels to supply the raw energy to recycle every molecule that comes out of a human being. It has some unpleasant-sounding effects to it, but that's what the Earth does do. And if you could recycle it, you wouldn't have to be sending up supply ships all the time. The saboteur unit does take carbon dioxide and at least removes the oxygen from it. Is saboteur somebody's proper name, or is it some kind of a contraction of, is that an acronym for what it does, for WS2N, K2LIW?
That's the guy that invented it, probably 80 years ago or so. That's where that comes from. Yeah, it's the final cycle, kind of thing. Because with the B, another fellow's name, and that's the final machine that they're working on to cycle. I'm trying to remember the chemistry. I can still see the letters and the arrows, how it all worked out. But now I forgot. It's been quite a few months since I've come across that. But they do have a final way of making this thing 100%. And don't forget, somebody was talking earlier about the length of time. You know, we've had people stay up for a year now in a space station. And Russians have gone up for a year or more at a time. And they like it so much, they've gone back. So you're always going to find people that are willing to go. On the ground, you have, again, in Russia, they had this, they went into this tank of, it was above ground for 500 days. You've got the Nemo's project off the coast of Florida, where they go down for weeks, two, 3 weeks at a time, a crew of four, five, or six people. And they spend time under the sea. People stay in caves. I think they call them cavenauts or something. they give them a name. So this is going on all over the place. There's a place in Utah simulating Mars for 80 days at a time. I don't think time is a problem. Back to you.
You don't think time is a problem. You put people in a confined, in a very confined little environment. Now, unless they're very rugged, psychologically rugged people, they can end up fighting each other and doing all kinds of terrible things. Developing claustrophobia or whatever. But the 120 watts that a human being is continuously generating as heat of the metabolism process. Of literally burning the food that you eat, combining it with the water and oxygen to burn the food to generate the oxygen, to generate the energy that you need, and other pieces of chemistry. In theory, all of that can be recycled. So if you take the waste products, solid, liquid, and the gaseous waste products coming out of the human being, I'm including the carbon dioxide, and you know what the others are, and reconvert it back into something that's consumable, you're putting back the energy that your body took out of those raw materials. So in theory, if you can complete that cycle, very difficult, then you wouldn't need a supply ship all the time for the International Space Station or any of these other space missions. And heaven help you if that machinery breaks down on a long trip to Mars. What's the fallback if that machinery breaks down? And almost anything that complicated is going to have a failure rate. In the case of the movie, let me drop this. In the case of the movie The Martian, when he's inside the vehicle, I can see how a saboteur will be taking the oxygen he exhales and recycling. But he's walking around outside wearing that helmet and an oxygen pack on his back. I'm having trouble believing that what he was wearing was capable of collecting the carbon dioxide that he's going to send back into the saboteur. So I think he was wasting the carbon dioxide when he's walking around outside the vehicle. Did I miss something on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
I believe there was an answer for that in the book. They didn't cover that in the movie. They had quite a... You gotta read the book. They cover a lot of details that I'm really missing in the movie. The movies, they always change things. That's standard. So maybe we'll have more fun if we go back to the moon. It looks like we'll be heading to the moon probably first before Mars than we think. By the way, they found a 31-mile lava tube, 31-mile long lava tube, and the diameter is, as it goes through is as big as a football field, like 300 feet wide, actually. And this thing is 31 miles long, about 200 to 300 feet under the ground there on the moon. Japan lunar satellite, Selene, took out trays of it years ago, and it took them all these years to analyze it and then confirm it with a couple of the other satellites that have been around there, GRAIL and LRO, that's the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, has confirmed all of it. So there's going to be a place that will be like a city, 31 miles long, filled with people and equipment years from now. Back to you, Dick.
The 31-mile long lava tube, is it filled up with lava, or is it completely empty? In other words, the excavation, if you could make a habitat, that is, let me pick a number, 50 meters below the surface of the moon, where the temperature is constant throughout the lunar day, you don't get subjected to the plus 150 degrees, minus 150 degrees centigrade, between the high noon and midnight on the moon. You get some ridiculous temperature extremes that are very difficult to tolerate, very life-threatening in each extreme. So if you've got a habitat that's below the surface, in theory you've got nearly constant temperature. And is this lava tube really empty? Is that excavation already done for us? Is the lava tube perpendicular to the surface, partially parallel to the surface? Give me some words on that lava tube, Paul. Address 2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, it's hollow. They did they sent radio waves down through, you know, into the ground, and probably around 80 meters. I would imagine. I haven't read that yet, but enough to penetrate the ground, and you know, a column. So yeah, it's a big empty thing, 31 miles long, and 300 feet wide. So, and 200 to 300 feet under the ground, and they do address that temperature. They're 150 centigrade swing. They also address the, you know, protect you from the radiation and, you know, micrometeorite bombardment and all of that. They know it, the inside is probably frozen, solid ice in some locations, and they'll be able to get that and use that for their survival. So, yeah, I just read about this recently, so. It's not on a pole. It's in mid-range. It's a place called Marius Hills, M-A-R-I-U-S. M-A-R-I-U-S Hills. I haven't looked it up yet. I want to look at the map and we'll find out where it is. Back to you.
Do I ask comments?
Go ahead, Bill.
I am just reading up on oxygen generators and CO2 scrubbers, and nothing that says that this is used in space, but there are apparently some scuba rebreathers that use lithium hydroxide canisters, which were used in the Apollo program, and other scuba rebreathers that use potassium superoxide. You said there's nothing here that says that potassium superoxide is used in space, but the nice thing about it is that it absorbs carbon dioxide and emits oxygen, and you get leftover potassium bicarbonate. So you'd have to carry the potassium superoxide with you and dispose of the potassium bicarbonate, but that would be one way of doing an oxygen generator and CO2 scrubber in a piece, although I think probably growing your own food with the CO2 would be a more sustainable way of doing things. There's also some mention of zeolite, which I think is what you guys were talking about a little while ago. I think that's maybe not what's in the Sabbath here, but it does say something about the space station having multiple systems, one flown based on these molecular sieves, as referred to as zeolite, ACQIS.
It's a no story. By the way, they use that zeolite thing on the Martian. Sabbath here for the Tranquility Module on the ISS, Sabbath here, breathing unit, Tranquility Module. I'm sure it'll get there. It's been up there probably since 2009 or so. Dick, over here.
AC2GS?
Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I was wondering if you wanted some information about the Sabatier device, and basically the Sabatier reaction is named after a French chemist from 1910. He discovered it. It's basically hydrolyzed water into oxygen and hydrogen. You mix it with carbon dioxide, and you get out methane gas that you further have to pyrolyze to pure carbon and hydrogen gas. And they're working on something called the Bosch reaction, which cuts out the middleman and goes straight from carbon dioxide and hydrogen all the way to pure carbon and water molecule. That's basically the Sabatier reaction and the Bosch reaction.
That's it. I knew it began with a B. Very good. And they take that hydrogen, Roy, and they dump that hydrogen right now. That won't happen in the future.
When they don't dump the hydrogen, what are they going to do with it, Paul?
Recycle it for the actual Sabatier effect, because it needs hydrogen.
That's right.
Methane contains hydrogen. Is that what you're saying?
No, methane can be reduced to hydrogen gas with pyrolysis, ultimately you end up with hydrogen, and you could use the hydrogen again to feed into the system. So you don't have to vent all of the hydrogen produced. You can tunnel some of it back on the device.
I get the impression, Paul, that the Saboteur device in its current form is fairly modern. Something that was invented in the last 10 years. And I presume it's a design that's continuously being worked on so that you get more and more efficiency of the conversion with less and less intermediate steps. Is that sort of the direction they're going, Paul?
Yeah, that's right. Like Floyd said, I thought it was 80 or 90 years ago. He said 2010. But 1910 it was invented. But this machine is relatively new. This is the first time they've flown it, and that was, I think, 2008, 2009. They've had some problems with it. It's broken down a few times. But they've reworked it. They've set up new valves. They had some problems with the valves, and they're getting better at it. They eventually want another unit up there. But it's relatively new. And like anything else, give them time, they'll get it.
As it presently stands, Paul, could I say that almost all fluids that come out of a human being, not only sweat, but you know what I mean by other fluids, are essentially all fluids coming out of a human being on the International Space Station, are all fluids recycled? Over to you, Paul.
Yes, they are. It's definitely a recycling biosphere up there, but you know, not 100% yet, but they're close. That's why they don't have to bring much up. I mean, if you look at the manifest on this last progress ship that went up, you know what I mean, they brought up some oxygen, 50 pounds of oxygen, that's it. They brought a lot of other stuff, but you know, out of the 6,000 pounds they brought up, you would think they'd be bringing up, you know, mostly oxygen. But it's all being recycled, most of everything's being recycled. Back here.
ETOIS coming.
Yeah, before I go over to you, Bill, can we make a rough estimate, Paul, as to what percentage of the oxygen the astronauts are breathing? What percentage of it is coming from electrolysis of water? What percentage of it is coming from oxygen bottles that are brought up? What percentage of it is coming from recycling the carbon dioxide they're breathing out? So, of the oxygen they're breathing, what are the rough percentages as to where it's coming from? Over to you, Paul.
I read 97% from electrolysis. They showed the machines. I have pictures of the machines somewhere. And that's where it's coming from. It's not like the old days with the fuel cells and everything. But this is how they're doing back here.
Okay, 97% from electrolysis of water. But isn't an awful lot of it coming out of the recycling from the Saboteur machine? Now, go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's, I don't know what percentage is coming out of that. But, you know, when everything is recycled back to water, now you have water again. So then you're using electrolysis to break that apart, and then you start breathing. It's going to wind up with carbon dioxide again. So, like Roy says, it's a step away with that other machine they're working on. That's not perfected yet. That's not in space. That final step.
Now, we're about to be cut off in a minute or two. AC2IS, K2RIW, go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick, listening to everyone's comments and wondering if we're all getting our space information off of the same webpage over at science.howstuffworks.com, which has a good page on carbon dioxide elimination. but over there they say that the saboteur unit is taking in CO2 from the quote-unquote CERA